Bowen goes, as far as the input and output. All right, very good. Just wanted to make that point and clarify into HOH.
Yeah, my name is Rob. I'm further down the band on the 1919 guys there, Mark and the guys there. So I go up there and talk to Randy once in a while, but I don't frequent up there. So, but if you look at my QRZ page, Whiskey 1, Whiskey Oscar Romeo, W1WR, you'll see a coil box there. And that coil box takes a 132-foot balanced dipole with 450-ohm open ladder line and switches that with night switches, and that coil in that box puts me on 160.
Yes, there really is more than one way to get it done. But as long as you have the real estate for the wire and the open line, you have it made.
Yeah, but the nice thing when I switch out of the 160 there, I got an 80-meter antenna, so I'm better off on 80 meters and 40 and stuff like that than trying to tune up, 200-some-odd foot there. So, all right. That was just a couple other things that I wanted to add in there. So, but the AT4K is, I use it for 60 meters in 160, and that's it. The Johnson Viking kilowatt matchbox is used for the rest of the bands there, so... All right, I'm going to pull the plug here, get into the witching hour. Not really, but get a couple of things done. Thank you for welcoming me in. 7-3s, everyone. Enjoy the day. We hopefully got some rain coming. It missed us again there. We're, today, tomorrow, and Tuesday, we're very bad in weather. So far right now, at least here, we only got less than 17 inches of rain there, and we need it bad. We're getting brush fires in the area, so... Be happy with your careful tossing those cigarettes out the window. W1WR.
Okie doke. Thanks again. Once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Limark Technical Net. We do have a few minutes left. It's up to you guys. If anyone has a question or a comment or a topic for discussion, we could beat it around the bush for a little while, or we could move on to the SpaceNet report. It's all up to you guys. Okay, I guess I heard my answer. Thanks to everyone who participated tonight, and... we'll be back next week to do it all over again. I hope you'll be able to join us. With no further ado, a little bit early, but I'm sure Paul could use the time. Let's hear from Paul WS2N for the SpaceNet report.
Okay, AC2GS WS2N SpaceNet report for the TechNet. Very good on the topics this evening. Yeah, so I was going to cover a couple of topics that I don't think has made the news. I found that on a couple of web pages that I visited and then I researched a little bit further. And apparently that this Chinese rocket was launched on the 9th of this month. And, first stage worked, second stage got into orbit, and it was going to put some cell phone communication broadband satellites into orbit for China. And this second stage, when it got into orbit, apparently it looks like it blew up, which, unfortunately, creates a debris mess. There's like 150 of these pieces that, according to our government, they could trap all these different pieces that are flying around. The second stage is, these are big vehicles. So they don't know why it blew up yet. Well, if they know, they haven't told anybody yet. But the orbit that it was in happens to be in the vicinity of a lot of these Starlink satellites, especially the lower ones that have just started to be launched. SpaceX has now, over 10,000 satellites up there. They were shooting for the higher orbits. Originally, above 300 miles. But now they're starting to lower that number to maybe 50 miles lower. And that's where this thing blew up. They've already had to move Starlink satellites out of the way of some of these pieces that are flying through space. The other bad thing about it is it was on a 52 inclination. The International Space Station's around 56, but it's close enough to every now and then come near the International Space Station. And they have enough problems, with the debris. They used to move the space station maybe once a year or so, when something was flying by, maybe an asteroid, but not a space chunk. And now they do it sometimes 3, 4, 5 times a year. So, this could be a problem. They said that they'll monitor all these pieces, but you have stuff flying at 17,500 miles an hour. That's not good. I remember a story years ago of one piece of paint was flying actually in the opposite direction of the space shuttle, and it hit the windshield of the space shuttle. And the reason it was flying in the opposite direction is because most rockets are launched to the east. They go in the direction of the Earth, the way it revolves. They try to get that extra push, that maybe 1,000 mile an hour extra push from the rotation of the Earth, so you use a lot less power to get to orbit. But some countries like Israel, they can't launch to the east because they're going to go over Arab countries and they don't want to risk a problem. So they launch to the west, and they launch over the Mediterranean and got one of their satellites to orbit. But there was some flaking that went on with their satellite. And the reason NASA knows that it was a piece of paint that hit the windshield of the space shuttle is because when the shuttle came back, they were able to do testing on this very small bit of molecules, and they figured out what kind of paint it was, and they knew that kind of paint was the one that they used on the satellites for Israel. But anyway, this 4-inch thick glass on the shuttle was okay, but it did create a bullseye type of a in the windshield itself. You could find it online pictures of this thing, of the glass itself. So you can imagine these roughly 150 pieces flying loosely, and they're tracking everything. They could track things down to, they'd say, around 10 centimeters, roughly around 4 inches, but there's things that are even smaller than that. And if that hits solar panels or the space station itself, it could cause some damage. So we'll have to see what happens. Things are really starting to get a little hairy on the International Space Station. And one of the things that's getting a little hairy on the space station is because of this ongoing leak. I know we've talked about it on the net before. On the Russian side, Russia has, half a dozen modules. There's roughly around 15 livable modules on the International Space Station. On the Russian side, the earliest flights was one of the modules was Zvezda. Before that was Zarya. Zarya is like the machine room of a skyscraper. That's got all the equipment and everything in there when they first sent that up. But then the second one that they sent up was Zvezda. Zvezda is the living module. They have living quarters for three cosmonauts, and, you know, their sleeping quarters, they eat there. They were doing science missions there. And the back end of this, that's where one of the docking modules is. So, you know, a Progress cargo vehicle will come up from Russia, or a crew vehicle might come up from Russia. Russia has four docking ports that they could dock to, and one of the main ones, and the first one was located in the Zvezda module. You know, and I know I've gone through this before, but just get, you know, nobody's heard it. Get into the Progress vehicle, which is the cargo version, you know, you would open up the hatch on the inside, and then you have to open up the next hatch on the Progress spacecraft. Or if it was a crew vehicle, the same thing. Both hatches would have to be open. But when they dock, you know, they're not touching each other. There's a vestibule in between it. There's this distance between the two, you know, around 3 or 4 feet. And the reason they have that is, you know, after it docks, they run pressure tests. You know, you have, after it docks, it's a complete vacuum. And they have to pressurize the area between the two vehicles before you could open up the doors. You know, even if you had a couple of pounds of pressure, you know, on the doors, you could not force those hatches open. You need to have equal on both sides. So they pressurize the vestibule area, and they're good to go. What happens is the leak is in that vestibule area, a very small, very fine crack. They eventually found one of these small cracks, but they think there's more. They just can't seal it properly, or they've tried to seal it, and it, you know, it spreads. It's like anything else. It's on a thin side. You know, the material itself, the metal material is on a thin side, and it keeps expanding. And it was not much air, but it has increased over the years. Back in 2009, they were losing around one pound of air per day. And in recent years, that's gone up to two or more. And they use kilograms. They say, well, it'll over 1 kilogram of air. And so Russians figure, okay, that's not acceptable. We'll try to fix it. And they've sealed it to some degree over the years, but lately it's been getting worse. And you might remember about a month ago, they had a great idea. We think we know where one of the cracks is, but to get to it, we're going to have to saw this support away to, you know, physically get to this area in the vestibule to try to seal it. And NASA was against that idea. So they took all their, they have five astronauts from the NASA side, the European Space Agency, and Americans, and they all got into a crew Dragon vehicle and hung out there while the Russians were going to saw the thing apart. Long story short, Russians changed their mind. They must have realized that this is a bad idea. So the thing was still leaking, and now they believe that they don't really have a fix for this. So what they're going to do, the latest move by Russia is, well, we're just not going to use this docking port anymore. We're just going to, that's it. We won't dock any vehicle to the Zvezda module. We'll just use the other three, which is okay. But unfortunately, that module is one of the main modules that has thrusters on it. You know, if you zoomed in on it, you could see it is thrusters. And those thrusters are used to push the space station. Let's say the debris coming by, it would push the space station, you know, so it doesn't intersect with the debris. That's another issue. So the cure for that is over the years, not because of that leak, because, you know, it was always planned that NASA would eventually have vehicles that could do the same thing. And they've experimented. They've done it with the Dragon vehicle. They've also done it with the Cygnus cargo vehicle by Northrop Grumman. They've docked with the space station. And, you know, after unloading all the supplies and everything, they'll fire the engines, and they're able to move the space station that way. So, you know, there is kind of like a plan B now. And I think they're going to pretty much have to go with that because, you would say, well, okay, you could take a Progress vehicle that has fuel in it and attach it to the docking port, light the engine and move to the space station. No problem. But you really can't do that because you need to pressurize, every time you do that, you need to pressurize the area in that vestibule because you have a weak point. If you have one side pressurized, the other side pressurized, and in between is the vacuum, and you put a strain from firing thrusters, you could actually create a strain where you, if there is a crack there, which they know there is, it could actually make it worse. So they're really kind of stuck, you know. I mean, in reality, it's not going to happen. You'd have to replace that whole surface module, the whole Zesda module, completely disconnected from the International Space Station and all their other modules that are attached to it, which you can't do. But, you know, I mean, theoretically, that would be the only way to fix it, by replacing the whole module. The vestibule part is part of that system. It's not like, a bolt-on piece. And they also know that this particular module, Zesda, with the vestibule, dates back to the 1980s. Before the International Space Station, you had Mir. Mir was the Russian space station that they had up there for 15 years. And, they had long-term plans back then with the USSR of eventually having another Mir space station. And one of the modules that was built was this existing Zesda module that's now part of the International Space Station. So all they did was just eventually shift that from becoming another Mir space station to part of the International Space Station. That module is really old, so I don't know. Keep following the story along. Any comments? WS2N. Okay, nothing heard. So, there's another fight that's coming up on the 27th of this month. And it's going to be a Pegasus launch. Right now, Pegasus is located temporarily in Wallops Island, Virginia, where they're getting it ready to launch a satellite called Link. What this mission is, it's basically a rescue mission, not for people, but for the Swift telescope. Swift telescope has been orbiting Earth since 2004. Done a great job, it looks for all these X-rays, it's been very successful for NASA. But over the years, it doesn't have thrusters to keep it at proper altitude. So over the years, it's been dropping. It's now roughly around 100 miles from where it used to be. And it's going to keep going. And they think within maybe a year or two, it might get low enough where, the air molecules will get to the point where it will keep slowing it down, where it would eventually deorbit. They've even tried to extend the life of the Swift by rotating it in a certain direction. This way it's not hitting the air molecules head on. So they've try that. They're trying to extend the life of it because they 9 months ago they said, oh, maybe we could have a contract, have a company build a spacecraft to go out and reboost it. And some company came along to do just that. A company called Catalyst. Catalyst is spelled, in this case, it's spelled with a K. So they come out of Arizona. In the months, they put together this spacecraft, and they plan on going up to grab this thing. I think by that time they get it, I think they said it might be as low as 150 miles or when they put this thing into orbit. And the idea is, it's called Link. Link will go up to the satellite. Now it's going to take like months to do this right. After it's in orbit, we'll fly to the telescope, and it's got these three arms, and when it gets very near it, well, you know, there's a lot that's going to happen. There's all kinds of laser technology on board and cameras. You're going to be taking pictures of the thing, but once they get ready and they get very close to it, these three arms are going to open up and wrap around it and kind of like grab it. Then the engine of the Link rescue vehicle will ignite and push this thing up to, you know, whatever, back to where it should be, you know, 300 or 400 miles, I guess, above the surface of the Earth. And I hope to do this without destroying the telescope. So I'll be interested in seeing that part of it. But to launch it, because of the inclination that it's on, and because of the time that's involved, when they realized that this thing was coming down lower and they needed to have a rescue mission, you know, they only had the 9 or 10 months to plan. They could do it with a bigger rocket. You could do it with a Falcon 9 SpaceX rocket, but you need a lot more time. You would need that time to put all this together, and there's no way that SpaceX was able to do that, or any of the other companies, the launch providers, couldn't say, we could do that. But this company, which is Northrop, said that we can. They built this Link satellite, and they're putting it into a Pegasus rocket to do the work. Now, Pegasus has wings, you know. It's attached to a jumbo jet. It's actually attached to the Lockheed L-1011, which, by the way, is the last L-1011 that exists. They made, like, I think 250 L-1011s. These were jumbo jets. The idea was to compete against their 747s. But, you know, they really were unable to compete because, for some reason, they said the cost of the L-1011 was too much to operate compared to what the other, like Boeing, could do. So they eventually got away from the commercial flights, and Lockheed just, you know, stuck with military or government work. But out of all these jets, this one NASA took over for years to use for launching the Pegasus rocket. This has been launched by jumbo jet, you know, for decades. I think back in the early 1990s, they started to use it. And it's had over 40 missions. And when I read recently, this is going to be the last Pegasus mission. So the last Pegasus mission, last flight of the L-1011. And they're going to hope to, go out on a high note by saving $500 million satellite, the SLIP telescope. So we'll see how that works out. Launch time would be the 27th of this month. So it's coming up a couple of few days, 6 days, I guess. And they flew the jet, or I guess they're in the process of flying the jet with the Pegasus rocket to Kwajalein Island. Kwajalein Island is out in the Pacific, one of these islands that they used during World War II. And they had an army base out there, still do. I think they named it for Ronald Reagan now. It's also the island, one of the islands that Elon Musk first started to use when he was testing his original rockets. They call it the Falcon 1, it only had one engine. This thing will take off. It'll fly in the easterly direction, and it'll release the Pegasus from the bottom of the L-1011. And Pegasus, it's a three-stage solid fueled rocket. So it'll take off, head to orbit, and hopefully at some point catch up to Swift and be able to do its job. They said, the end of the mission, by the time they get into orbit, put it into a proper location and grab the satellite and eventually move the satellite to where it's got to go. I think they said it's going to take many, many months to actually do this. Any comments? WS2N. Going on my rig is starting to get a little hot, so I just put an auxiliary fan. Got one of those battery operated fans, small enough to be on a desk where the rig is. So the Dragon spacecraft, they have two versions, the cargo version and the crew version. Right now there's one cargo version that just separated from the space station last week and headed back to the Pacific. That's where they land them now. And the crewed vehicle is still attached to the space station, but the cargo version left. And what's good about the Dragon cargo vehicle, they recover it, comes back on parachutes. SpaceX has their own ships out there. They pick it up. And they said the scientists are going to be very happy about this one because there's literally tons of science experiments that have been done on the space station that they're waiting to get their hands on, with arthritis and things to do with heart disease and different cancers. There's probably hundreds of scientists waiting to get the spacecraft back to land. So it lands in the water, they pick it up, and then eventually they float the whole thing they launch from San Diego. So they have, SpaceX has their facilities there, and they have them in Hawthorne, California. So eventually they'll get the vehicle back, they'll be able to open it up, and send all the stuff back to wherever it goes. A lot of it's in refrigerated compartments or cryogenic compartments, so you have plenty of power on board to keep these things refrigerated to whatever temperature they need. So right after it lands, they get a hold of it, and that's why nothing is destroyed. So, that is one of the benefits of the space program. Over the years, they've done a lot of science, especially
especially medical research. And I'm sure it's helped make the different decisions on what people should do here on Earth. In regard to eyesight, they're always curious about that. Blood flow. Recently, not too long ago, they had the one guy who had some kind of a cardiac problem. They had to bring the crew back early for that. I still never found out the positive result of what happened to that guy. But anyway, he's okay. But all these things that they do up there, they're going to need for future flights to the moon, eventually Mars. Any comments? Okay, UL, United Launch Alliance, they plan on launching a mission in September. Apparently they're getting the go-ahead to do that. They've had some issues with, not with their rockets, but with the solid booster rockets that they attach to the Vulcan rocket. They've launched four times so far, and two of the flights, they've had issues with the nozzle of the booster rockets breaking up. And apparently the first time they thought they had it cured, and then eventually it happened again. So we'll see if that's been resolved. But if they could get Vulcan back to operation, they'll be able to start completing dozens of these flights that they have on their manifest for Amazon. Amazon has the goal to put 3,200 satellites into orbit very a short period of time if they can. They only have about 10% of that up there right now. So they need a lot more flights. They're contracted with the European Space Agency. So the Ariane 6 flight recently launched, I think it was around 38 of these satellites up there. Vulcan has the capability of even launching more. I think they're going to launch over 40 of their satellites. Collectively, you're looking at like 30 or more tons of satellite material that has to get into orbit when you add all these things together. You know, it's like putting 30 cars into orbit. So, yeah, Amazon, they believe they have better satellites than what SpaceX has. They believe that they don't have to worry about them losing altitude. SpaceX, they say they lose at least one or two satellites per week for different reasons. They might, be malfunctioning. If they do, they have all ion thrusters on board each satellite that they can slow themselves down and deorbit. Sometimes the atmospheric drag with the, you get solar activity and the atmosphere expands. That creates more molecules up there, which hurts the lower flying satellites. And SpaceX has two layers of satellites. They have high ones, I think 380 miles up, and then they have low ones. Low ones are subject to rarefied air slowing things down, and they're constantly losing them. Where Amazon, their height is going to be higher, and by doing that, they'll never come down. If they do start to lose altitude, they do have thrusters on board those as well. I believe they're ion thrusters too. Although I haven't really seen an exact design of the Amazon satellite for some reason. That's like top secret. But one of these days, I'm sure Jeff Bezos will release the
satellite. So, they've contracted, even with SpaceX has launched some of the satellites for Amazon. And that's their direct competitor. Vulcan will be the main one for a while. They have a lot, like dozens of flights on schedule to launch Amazon. The New Glenn rocket that just blew up earlier this month, that one will be able to. I think they're around 45 satellites on that. Anyway, that be between the Ariane rockets, SpaceX, New Glenn, and also Atlas. Atlas has done about three or four flights now for Amazon as well. But they can't put that many up. I think they put around 20. I knew that was going to happen. Anyway, Jeff Bezos to start operation with broadband, he needs at least half that amount. So he needs 1,500 up there. So he kind of like told the government, we're going to have this up by now. So we're going to take all these frequencies and we're going to be able to utilize them. But the government didn't want to turn over those frequencies to them unless they can guarantee all these satellites will be in orbit. Why should Blue Origin claim these frequencies forever? I mean, say they don't put any satellites up there. Are all these bands going to be locked out because of that reason? And the answer is no. They're not going to let them do that. So as it is now, that he's not going to make it in time, but I'm sure that the way politics works, I'm sure he'll get that extension. Any comments? Okay, we haven't talked about the Starship flights lately. The last one was number 12, and that kind of was a success. Certain things that went on was okay, but other things like the booster, brand new booster, new design, that didn't work out when that separated from the Starship itself. Starship made it into space, but the booster itself started flipping over end for end, and it started to roll. It came crashing back into the Gulf of Mexico. And not the way they wanted to. They want, they want to control flight. They want to make it where it's almost like coming back to a launch pad. But that didn't happen. It started going out of control right after it separated from the Starship itself. Starship was okay. It did some of the things that they wanted to do. They showed that they could launch 20 satellites, even though they were all dummy satellites. The flight was not an orbital flight. It was suborbital. In other words, it goes up, from Texas and comes down in the Indian Ocean. Doesn't go into orbit. And the reason for that is SpaceX and the government, they don't want to put a big, gigantic spaceship into orbit and find out, hey, we can't get this thing to deorbit. The way they know that they could deorbit it would be to reignite the engine, or at least one of the engines, light three of the engines to deorbit. And they haven't even relit one of them yet. They've tried it quite a few times. And they were unable to do it on this last number 12 flight. So now they're going to launch number 13, and they say that's going to be sometime in July. And again, it's not even planned to go to orbit. Another suborbital flight. These think are three times more powerful than, like, the Saturn V that put, you know, put people on the moon. Massive thrust coming out of these things. About 400 feet tall, like a 40-story building, 27 feet in diameter. And they haven't gotten one into orbit yet. And when 13 goes up, they need to be able to relight that engine to show that they can relight it. This way, future flights like number 14, maybe that will make it into orbit. And then they know with confidence they'll be able to relight an engine and bring it on home. So we'll have to wait and see what happens next month. Any comments? Put in that WS2X. Okay, nothing heard. Trump administration has given up the idea of disconnecting these satellite. Well, they're satellite connected pieces of equipment out in the ocean. They have things floating in the ocean. They have things at the bottom of the ocean. Around the world, they have these detectors. They can tell, wave heights. They can tell currents, temperatures. All this information is fed to overhead satellites. They pretty much use the Iridium satellites to do this. And I think they, around 5 gigahertz or so, they transmit up. And they also transmit back down if they need to direct these, change what these sensors are doing around the world. The Trump administration recently let's disconnect everything. We don't want this. So naturally, there was a big pushback, and pushback always works. So they backed off on that. They did manage to disconnect a few of them. They set up in Oregon, the waters near Oregon, and the waters near the Washington State. So they started to do it so that they'll have to replace them somehow. But, there's a constant move to, to do away with science. Pushback came from the National Science Foundation, NSF. They're really trying to cut that group out. In fact, they might have laid off a lot of people in the beginning. And I think, all these things are used to have, big operations. Who knows? It's probably just a skeleton crew. Same thing with NOAA. All these different agencies. But I'm glad to see that this is not going to be lost. They would have lost, years of information. They've been doing this for, countless years. Weather, oceans, all that information over the years. And they said if they'd lost, a couple of years of information, devastating, because in the future they would bring it all back. But you would have this gap, and they don't need that. Especially now, I think there's some kind of an El Nino event that's happening this year. So without any comments, if not, we're going to close down early. This is WS2X. Anyway, I'm going to pass it back to you, Roy. Anybody that's listening will be on tomorrow. Check into the Limewalk Info ClubNet, and that's always followed by Swap and Shop, followed by Radio Newsline. And I'm sure they'll be talking a lot about the upcoming Field Day event. Back to you, Roy. AC2GS, WS2N for the SpaceNet Report for the TechNet. Back to you.
Okay.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for all that you do on the technical net and all that you do for the club. We all appreciate it, as I do appreciate all the people who participated tonight here. Hope you had fun. Hope you learned some things. I hope you'll join us next Sunday night when we try this all over again. So as per usual, let me tell you a couple of closing comments from some of our some clever men. One of our own Dick, K2RIW, who always used to end his technical nets with the request to be kind to each other. That's always good advice. And good old Epictetus. It's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So keep your mind open to new ideas, but not so wide open that your brain falls out. Everyone, I hope you had a good Father's Day. Stay safe, be well. If you can, come back next Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we'll do this all over again. This is AC2GS, and I will be clear when I say Slava Ukraini.
Happy Father's Day to all it applies to, the UB2BX. So have a good night, Roy. Have a good night, Paul.
Okay, 73, Frank. Have a good one. We'll try to be here next week.
That's time complete. That's tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater.
Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater.
Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater. This is the W2VL repeater. Good morning. The time is 5 o'clock a.m.
Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater.
AE2GJM listening. AE2GJM listening. AE2GJM listening. AE2GJM listening. AE2GJM listening. AE2GJM, one thing. AE2GJM, one thing. AE2GJM, one thing. AE2GJM.
K2KMB, good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Richie. How are you?
I'm good. Did you have a good Father's Day yesterday?
Oh, it was terrific. We went to Cafe Red, and we went to church, and we went to the beach swimming at the east end of Duncan Metal State Park. It was great.
Yeah, we were up with our in-laws from my younger son's family. It's like all the families get together so that the kids don't have to make different runs to different houses. So we're up in Chappaqua. It was a really nice day. It got cloudy around 4:30, quarter to 5 or so. It actually started to rain for a bit. So that's where we left. But it was a nice day. Weather held up nice. So everything was good.
Aunt's having a problem again.
I missed part of what you said. I think you said the car's having a problem again. You said that you had the problem with the phone linking up. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
Well, I guess you're going to take it back in again, have them check it out. Sometimes there's just too many mechanical things there, but don't forget, there's so many different, I mentioned that everything is by electronics in there, in cars today. There's all kinds of transmitters, transmitting information about the brakes and the transmission and everything else, so you'll find it.
So I should definitely bring it back in, right?
I don't know. I think I said on Friday, maybe do a Google search as to, well, let's back up. What kind of phone do you have? Do you have an iPhone?
iPhone 16.
And then the car is using, it's supposed to connect automatically to the iPhone, and that's where you get, you travel, I guess, I don't know, you can use it from that also, or that comes from a separate system?
No, I use Siri.
So, just do a Google search on connecting your phone. I assume it's connecting over Bluetooth, and if something is happening with the Bluetooth, that may be a setting that you go into the car, and you go into settings, and it pairs with that. I told you, well, you said you did it just with your phone and not with your wife's phone. But We have the same problem with our car sometimes, that if my daughter's driving the car and wants to connect to her phone, it won't connect, and it should. It should connect to any phone that you tell it to connect to. So I would just do a Google search. How do I make sure that my iPhone connects to my 2024 Audi or whatever the car is? And they may tell you to go into settings and they may be missing something in settings.
Yeah, but why does this happen all the time? Shouldn't it stay like that or no? Shouldn't it connect all the time since you did it the first time?
Yeah, I don't know the answer, Paul, but, I had a similar problem. I just back in March, got a new set of hearing aids, and they were not connecting correctly, even though they'd been set initially to work, they weren't connecting. And so I had to go back to Costco, and they had to make a whole new adjustment, and they had to do an upgrade, and that could be part of it sometimes, too. Because don't forget, I believe you have live, particularly in the Audi, you probably have a live update whenever Audi decides to do an update to their linking system. And sometimes with an update, it may go back and set a default that you had changed. So that's why I say do a Google search, not a big deal. Google search what you're trying to do and see what they come up with.
The car also talks to me, and I don't push it or anything. It just comes up saying, we're in Chicago, where do you want to go?
Yeah, what are you talking about? The GPS? Is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
Yeah, well, that's just the way that they have it set up, but that's coming up. Is that what you're saying? That's coming up automatically? And what's not coming up? Hearing your telephone messages through the phone?
No, it just starts talking to you out of nowhere, and I don't do anything to the car.
Yeah, I don't know a lot about it. That could be something with Siri, where you can have Siri always listening, or Siri always just responding when you say, "Hey Siri," or something like that. That's a possibility.
I never say has Siri.
I understand that, but what I'm saying is there may be a setting that has Siri always listening. I don't know how it works, but it's got to do a Google search and say this is what I'm trying to do. And again, it may be they'll tell you go into the Audi setting and change something that will stop it from speaking whatever it feels like speaking.
Yeah, but this problems come on when I'm driving. You can't just stop the car in the middle of the highway and do this.
Yeah, I understand that part of it, but if it's a defect, then obviously, yeah, you've got to go back to the manufacturer. But if it's a setting, I don't know the settings of the phone or the car. But that's why I say if you do a Google search, you may just...